This podcast of The Treatment is a production of KCRW Santa Monica and KCRW.com. Support for KCRW podcasts comes from the Southern California Lexus dealers.
From KCRW in Santa Monica, this is The Treatment.
Welcome to The Treatment. I'm Elvis Mitchell. My guest is Peter Guralnick. His new book, after two incredible books on Elvis Presley, is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. Peter, thanks so much for being here.
Well, thank you. I'm really glad to be here.
One of the things I think is so remarkable about the book that really, really sort of explains a lot of Sam, there are two aspects, that Olympian sort of sense of self-confidence, self-regard, and a kind of narcissism that defined him as an artist, and anger that nobody has ever talked about before.
Well, I think so. I think you can see this is a thread all the way through. I think it derives from many things. It derives from his life as a black man at a particular time in history when the experience of every black person, you know, regardless of whether they were in entertainment or not, was an experience of continual humiliations of, you know, not just daily but hourly. And as an entertainer, he faced this over and over again. But most of all, I think you're right, that sense of anger stemmed from a sense of almost supreme confidence in himself, a sense that he had been instilled in him by his father, that there were no limits to what he could do, and there should be no limits to what he could do, and that no one should be allowed to place those limits on him from the outside. And the result of this was an extraordinary kind of self-confidence, and perhaps even to a degree a sense of self-absorption from an early age. His father, whom I interviewed when he was 98, said of him he was head man from an early age, and this is a child, this is the fifth child of eight. All of his brothers and sisters saw him as someone set apart, but it's equally clear that Sam saw himself as someone set apart. And when he felt that he was being disrespected or being played, his anger, his sense of indignation would flare up, whether it was in a situation which reflected prejudice or a situation in which he simply felt that he was being insulted. And there were acts of anger. I don't want to call them violence exactly, but he was not reluctant to get into a fight.
But there are outbursts, certainly, that seemed to almost, given his essentially kind of placid and soothing tenor as a person, these outbursts kind of came from nowhere, didn't they?
Yeah. No, I mean, they did, and they were totally surprising when they arose, because I think for the most part, those people who knew him or those people who, you know, merely encountered him saw this sophisticated, intellectual, engaging, totally charismatic, someone who could charm, you know, I don't want to say the birds out of the trees, but I mean, he could charm anyone and did charm everyone. As I went around doing interviews, I had gotten up maybe to 200 or so when I realized that there was no one whom Sam Cooke had met whose life wasn't touched by Sam in some really meaningful way. And the stories that I got were over and over again stories of the example Sam had set, of the instruction he had given, of the way in which he had directly affected this person's life. But the fact is that when that anger erupted, it came as a terrible shock, you know, not just to the public, which rarely, rarely saw it, but in particular to the people that he loved. And for example, to his wife, Barbara. I think that she felt this. She was someone, she met him when she was barely 13. He was 17. It was love at first sight. It was a very difficult love. It was
one of many loves.
That's right. And it was in the midst of many loves. But I think it was a true love, and yet Sam disappointed her. Now, Barbara doesn't paint herself in any, you know, as any saint, not in the least. And I could have written a book about Barbara. But Barbara, too, was surprised by the degree, by the self-absorption, which to some extent was the source of Sam's gift as an artist, or gifts as an artist. He was not only an introspective person, but almost a solitary person in his own way. But when that solitude was intruded upon, he could definitely flare up. And when that sense of his own dignity and his own worth was stepped upon, he reacted, and he reacted quite strongly.
It's The Treatment. I'm talking to Peter Guralnick. His new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. But that narcissism aside, he had kind of an incredible sense of himself, almost talking about himself in third person. I remember a section in the book, and for me the most powerful section is the last third of the book, when he really becomes Sam Cooke, where he's on the Mike Douglas show talking about the Copa, and he just comes out and says, I bombed the first time I played the Copa. And that's not the kind of thing that you would expect somebody who is that narcissistic to do. But he had a real sense of his own failures and moving forward from them, didn't he?
Well, he did. He did very much, and I think that's due to his analytic cast of mind. I just want to back off of the narcissism for 1 second, because while I'm not disputing your view of this, your view of the self-absorption and the extent to which almost his artistic daring sprang from that, I also think that from my point of view, his charm, his charismatic qualities never faded, despite the fact that they were interrupted.
I don't mean to say that, because I know there's kind of an awkward and derogatory cast in narcissism, mm-hmm. but if there were a term for earned narcissism,
right,
because
right.
He had such an understanding of his talent, mm-hmm. and basically even as a boy, as you point out in the book, he was charming everybody.
Yes.
Even as a young child, every girl was in love with him.
Mm-hmm.
And you sort of see how that charm sort of influenced somebody like Aretha Franklin, who said just by dint of watching him saying, well, I can do that if he can do it. I can
right,
move from
right.
gospel into pop.
Right, right. And look at the story that his brother L.C. tells about how at the age of 7, when L.C. is 5, Sam announces to his younger brother, I figured out the system, and I'm not going to take any part in it. I'm not going to have a 9-to-5 job, because when you're working a 9-to-5 job, at the end of the week, you're just as broke as when you started. And L.C. looks at me, and he says, can you imagine that? He's talking about the system. I got no idea what he's talking about. I don't know. How does he know what the system is? And L.C. turns to Sam, and he says, well, what are you going to do then? He says, I'm going to sing, and I'm going to make a lot of money. The point of this is you could think that this is an after-the-fact kind of a story, but L.C. Sam's brother L.C. simply doesn't think in those terms. And the language that people used the language of the people who knew Sam best used in describing Sam was not really their own language. Bobby Womack, L.C., even J.W. Alexander, who mentored Sam, when they spoke of Sam, spoke of this person who was always moving forward and spoke of someone who to this day they're still trying to understand. But they don't agree on anything else. I mean, there are great divisions among the various people, and Barbara Cook, Sam's wife, and the Cook family, anyone, they would tell you in an instant, never liked each other from the moment they met. And yet when they speak of Sam, they speak of someone who is able both to analyze a situation, to stand apart from it, and sometimes to stand apart from it to a degree that they can't interpret.
It's the dream. We're talking to Peter Goronic. His book is Dream Boogie. It's an astonishing biography of Sam Cooke. I think the thing I end up taking away from the book so much is people being just kind of stunned at his forward thinking.
Mm-hmm.
And there are a couple of sort of things that come to mind. Both times I'm talking to Bobby Womack about the future, hearing Bob Dylan sing and saying, I should have written that. A black man should have written that song,
right.
Blowing in the Wind. And then later telling Bobby Womack about when they first heard the Rolling Stones that this is the future, and Bobby Womack saying Mick Jagger can't sing. And, of course, as we know, years later, he ends up singing with the Rolling Stones, Bobby Womack.
Right, and here's a case where, as you say, Sam isn't making any judgments. He's observing the present day. I think he said that the key to writing a successful song was living in the present, observation and reflecting the present day. And in this case, it's not that he's making a judgment about it. It wasn't just the Rolling Stones. It was the Animals. Bobby Womack is saying, those cats can't sing. He says, they don't sound like Archie Brownlee of the Five Blind Boys. They don't sound like June Cheeks. They're not great singers. And Sam says, you've got to put that all aside. And he says, in fact, Sam goes beyond that and says, you know how you guys are performing in these sort of band suits that he and J.W. Alexander had gotten for them, just the standard R&B thing. He says, you've got to go out there and just be yourself. And that's what the people are going to go for. And he says, it was almost like Moses on the mountain or something. I mean, he was saying, I'm not going to see this, or I can't take advantage of it, Sam was saying about himself. He says, but this is going to work for you guys, and you're going to be a bigger star than you can ever imagine, but in that style, in that new style, because people believe the singer-songwriter. They believe Bob Dylan. You've got to set aside your preconceptions.
In some ways, he kind of reminds me of basketball players who are smart and talented. I mean, Isaiah Thomas even talked about this a few years ago. And because there's so much talent, their intelligence is sort of given short shrift.
Mm-hmm.
And you go through great pains to sort of talk about that calculation, that analysis he's constantly using, and basically, for example, talking about pop song as being something very simple to get a simple sentiment across so that everybody understood it.
Yes, and yet to have undertones which give it a depth that bubblegum music doesn't have, to have either an element of melancholy, either through the melodic structure or through the way that he phrases or even occasionally through the words, or in a sense creating characters. When he does Twisting the Night Away, he sees a broadcast from the Peppermint Lounge. He sees high society trying to do the twist. And he creates a storyline out of this. It's a very simple storyline, but his belief was, just like any writer, that he has to draw in the listener, he has to hook the listener with characters in the story with which they can identify. In a way, it's like Lieber and Stoller songs. It's a little playlet. His thing, I think, is not unlike that of any other great creative artist. There's a highly analytic part of it, and then there's the willingness and the ability to let himself go. And analysis isn't going to get you anywhere if you can't let go in the end.
And apply those lessons, too.
And apply those lessons. No, but in other words, you learn technique in order to free yourself of technique. You have the technique to fall back on, whether it's Hemingway or Faulkner or whatever it is. But essentially, what he did was the very opposite of painting by the numbers. If technique alone is painting by the numbers, but once you've absorbed technique, once you've absorbed the facts or whatever it is, and then you just let your feelings go, it's like that Chet Baker thing, let's get lost. That's what he aimed to do, and it was the combination of those two things that I think made him a great artist.
For me, a real emblematic Sam Cooke song, and the thing is, the titles always make them sound kind of innocuous. Mm-hmm. Do you think just about how seductive they are and how he basically repeats using gospel repetition and mm-hmm. crooning to put the song across? And for me, that song is Everybody Loves the Cha-Cha-Cha, just the way he sort of ends that sort of instruction with it and then starts to sing and fade out. It's really kind of we're taking something very simple and almost trivial and frivolous and making something very kind of emotional out of it.
Well, no, exactly. I mean, you know, and this is 1-2, cha-cha-cha. But I mean, but here it stems from his going to a party at Lou Rawls' mother's house and watching the children, including his daughter Linda, doing the cha-cha, and somebody yells out, everybody cha-cha, and he writes the song on the spot. But the song that he writes is not about Sam Cooke at a children's party, just as the song that when he writes Another Saturday Night. It's not about his own experience, which suggests the song, which is he's staying in the Maharaja suite at the Mayfair Hotel in London with J.W. Alexander, and the security guards tell him, I'm sorry, gentlemen, you can't bring these girls up to your room, which led to two things. One was switching hotels immediately, but the other was to write a song, a fictionalized song of that experience, a humorous song of that experience, cast in terms that anybody could understand, and Saturday night and I just got paid, and, you know, it's... you know, I'm in an awful way. I mean, but it's derived directly from real experience, and yet creates another realm in a sense, just as the cha-cha song creates another dimension to the actual experience, which is what imaginative literature and any form of creative imagination does do.
It's the treatment. We're talking to Peter Goronic, his great new book, and I can't say this enough. This is a biography of Sam Cooke, Dream Boogie. I guess I end up thinking about this so much because the thing you really get across in the book that's been missing so much about him, besides talking about his intelligence, is also his impatience.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, it wasn't like he was constantly drumming his fingers, but that just sort of sense of, well, what's next for me? What do I do next? And how do I take advantage of what is going on around me now? And that way of just taking these things you talked about and you talk about in the book, these things that sort of happen, and give them another cast and putting them out for everybody to sort of identify with.
No, he was always thinking about the next thing, and to the very end of his life, to the very last day of his life, he was moving ahead. He had 12 different plans, all of which I'm sure he would have implemented, including going to Vegas, including making movies, including making his new album was going to be a Gut Bucket Blues album that was based on the music of Muddy Waters, Howlin' Wolf, and John Lee Hooker.
At the same time, he's becoming, in his own way, subtly more militant and more affirmed in his blackness by growing an afro, essentially, having his hair be longer,
mm-hmm.
going away from that sort of that essentially the black version of the Pat Boone close crop haircut.
Well, I mean, the afro, for example, this was something. The moment that he had a hit, within 6 months of that, he stopped using the process and went over to the afro and proselytized other singers, none of whom, you know, would even consider wearing their hair natural. Proselytized them to say, why do we want to be looking like them? Let's be proud to be ourselves. But you spoke about, you know, it's funny. I was going to call the book originally, the subtitle originally was going to be The Education of Sam Cooke, because I saw him as soaking up every lesson that came his way instantly and then moving on. And I'll give one example. I mean, it's just he signs a contract the day before he goes in for the recording session to cut You Send Me, which becomes his first hit. He signs a songwriting contract. And it's a songwriting contract in which he gives away half of his mechanical royalties, essentially half of his songwriter royalties. He doesn't know, he's never signed a songwriting contract. Well, he has as a member of a group, but he doesn't really know what this means. Within, I would say, weeks, he recognizes what he's done. And in the meantime, he switches record companies. There's a whole story attached to this. But what does he do in a capitalist society, having been essentially been taken advantage of for his failure to understand the language. I mean, this is what it is. In any capitalist transaction, if you don't know the language, you're always going to lose. He recognizes, he signed the contract, which gives away half his royalties if he wrote the song. So what does he do? He immediately recalls, he very fortuitously recalls that he didn't write the song at all. It's his brother Elsie who wrote the song. This enrages the record company owner, a very bright man and a man who prides himself on living up to every single term, every single, you know, comma of his contracts. But this was a contract that was definitely to his advantage, not to Sam's. There's a year and a half lawsuit, which ends with Elsie singing the song for the judge, and the judge declaring for Elsie and Sam, saying it's a wise father who knows his own child. But that's quick. That's quick education.
And constant. We'll take a break here. I'm talking to Peter Gromnick. It's The Treatment. His new book is Dream Boogie, The Triumph of Sam Cooke. We'll be right back.
You're listening to The Treatment with Elvis Mitchell from the studios of KCRW Santa Monica.
It's The Treatment. My guest is Peter Gromnick, of whom I've been a fan forever. His new book is Dream Boogie, the Triumph of Sam Cooke. It's such a great story because so much of it leads to the end. I mean, there's this sort of build. And we were talking before we got started. And it's hard to think of another career that ended up, and we're talking about, you said, of course, it would have been tragic if he died under any circumstance. And as you make very clear in the book, he could have died decades earlier when he stood up for himself in a similar way in a hotel in Shreveport. And let's just tell that story.
Well, I mean, actually it was just a year before.
Oh, right, that's right.
In October of 1963 that he went to, he arrived in the middle of the night after a long night's drive to register at a motel in Shreveport. Actually, it was the first Holiday Inn in Shreveport, the Holiday Inn North, in case you have one. Well, it's not called that anymore.
Let's hope not.
But I went there. I got my picture taken there because it was just so weird. I just had to find where it was. Anyway, Sam goes to register and they say, "I'm sorry, sir, we have no reservations." When they take a look at him, it was peculiar because Holiday Inn was the first integrated chain, and that's
why. And lots of black entertainers stayed there. Yeah, sure.
That's right. But in any case, he goes there, and for whatever reason, let's say that the night manager was a racist, they say, "I'm sorry, sir, you have no reservations." He's with his brother Charles, who would gladly accept the term thug or, you know. Charles is a true gangster, you know.
Yes.
And he's with his wife Barbara. He's with his road manager and the founder of the Soul Stirrers, S.R. Crane. They implore Sam. They do everything that they can to get him away from there. He shouts. He screams. He swears at the night manager. You know, finally, his wife, Barbara, says, "You know, Sam, we've got to leave here. They're going to kill you." He says, "They're not going to kill me. I'm Sam Cooke." She turns to him and she says, "Honey, to them, you're just another N-word." You know, at that point, I mean, they finally pull away. He's thrown in jail. You know, there's a great brouhaha. It makes all the national papers. But the point is, he could just as easily have been killed right there as he was a year later, and for much the same reason, because his father had brought him up, but his inclination, his temperament had taught him, or it was such, that he would never, ever allow himself to be played. He would never, ever allow himself to be disrespected.
It was that enormous sense of entitlement that I also think makes him a real modern pop figure in the way that other people weren't. I mean, because you talk about in the book the lessons that he accretes from other people, but still that sort of entitlement of his that was not particularly American. I tend to think it was being more for people like Harry Belafonte or Sidney Poitier, who were not born in the United States and didn't have the same relationship to their blackness that Americans did. He basically led his life like that.
Well, I never thought of it. I mean, this West Indian thing actually makes a lot of sense, and I never thought of that at all. But, I mean, a similar thing happened in Memphis several years earlier where a cop tells him to move the car, and they go through this whole thing. He says, "You know, I'm a singer. I don't move cars. And, you know, if I were Frank Sinatra, you wouldn't ask me to move the car." And the argument intensifies. And in the end, he says, "I'm Sam Cooke. You may not know who I am, but your wife does. And, I mean, it's kind of like, what does that say back in 1960 in Memphis? I mean, how bold a statement is that, and how risky a statement is that? So again, but the centrality of this in both stories, which were told to me by two different people, or several different people actually, mm-hmm. the centrality of it is, I'm Sam Cooke, which bears out your thesis.
I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment. My guest is Peter Garonick. We're talking about this incredible book, Dream Boogie. Because all of this we're talking about leads up to all those theories that you recount, a number of them, about his death. And one of the things that strikes me, and I guess links this to, and I wonder if you actually came across this when you were doing the research for the Elvis Presley book, when Presley even says that he thought that basically Sam was killed because he got too big for his britches.
Yeah,
they had to
bring
him down.
Yeah.
That's an incredible thing to hear from Elvis Presley, too, isn't it?
Well, yeah, it is, and it also is something which gave Elvis pause and which I think frightened Elvis in a certain way. It may have been used on Elvis, too.
You think so?
The psychology that he couldn't go against what was planned for him. He couldn't violate a contract. I mean, I think Elvis is almost the opposite of Sam in that respect anyway, in that Elvis proved the docile.
In many
character.
Respects, he's the opposite.
Yes.
People,
it's
in this weird way, you know, if it's the forest, then Sam is the fox and Elvis is the rabbit.
Well, yeah, exactly. And while both were highly intelligent people and both, for example, were voracious readers, but Sam read with a purpose and he had, I keep saying this, but he had a highly analytic cast of mind.
And unlike Elvis, he knew how to discard people. I mean, he goes through agents, he goes through all kinds of people in his career, and Elvis never did.
No, Sam left people when he had outgrown them. He left people behind, whether they were black or white. Somebody like Bumps Blackwell, who's been painted very romantically in the past and who always paints himself as the center of the story, I mean, always did when he was alive, Sam recognized very intelligently, I think very cannily, that Bumps had taken him as far as he could, that he had gone as far as he could with Bumps. And he discarded Bumps, but in a way that always tried to continue to offer Bumps something to maintain a good relationship with Bumps, like Bill Clinton, like Elvis too. He always wanted to be loved, and he never wanted to leave anyone behind in a personal sense, but he left everyone behind as he moved along to a higher plane. I mean, the one person who stayed with him all the way through was his friend J.W. Alexander. And J.W. was the inspiration for this book. He was not only a brilliant man himself, but just a truly wonderful person. And I wish, just for the sake of anything, we could just have a recording of his laugh right here, because anybody would enjoy his laugh. It was just the most wonderful thing. He was a very sophisticated, suave, charming, and very kind person. But, even J.W., Bobby Womack speculated that Sam might have even left J.W. behind if he had stayed alive. I don't think so, but it was certainly, it was not his nature to linger.
I'm glad you brought this up, because for me, the difference between these two figures, all other things aside, between Elvis Presley and Sam Cooke, is that Sam had the benefit of the family and being loved in the family and really just being propped up by his family, essentially being carried along by them and taking that love and in this way sort of giving it out to people, you know, and being very sort of sparing and even teasing with it.
Right.
Whereas Elvis Presley desperately wanted that love, and once he had people around him, because his family life was so blasted and he was sort of pushed in ways that sort of basically distorted him, he wanted to sort of keep a family around him, whereas Sam created a new family literally in almost every situation he went into.
Well, I think that's true to a degree. I think my view is Elvis, nobody could have been more loved than Elvis was by his parents, and he continued to live with his father until his death, essentially. I mean, his father might have moved down the street, but they worked together, lived together. There was a deep dedication. But they were an isolated family. They were a family set apart from anybody else, even in the community.
But also he had this thing, all the expectations being put on Elvis by his mother. He just...
Well, as an only child and as somebody who was almost... But I guess the point that that agrees with what you're saying is that he created a kind of family, what he imagined as a family, two times. One was by getting these guys around him. And I'm not deprecating the people around him. But they were a substitute for a family. They weren't a real family. And the other was that in terms of his marriage, he created an idealized sense of what marriage family would be, whereas in fact it simply wasn't anything like that for him.
I think over your entire career you kind of felt a mission, I would say, to sort of show that pop music and its creators aren't simple or simple-minded people, and that this – in fact, for them, was a real kind of exegesis, this sort of expunging of everything that they had been, everything they had become. In some cases, they only evolved to a certain point, like Elvis. Or in Sam's case, there's this constant state of evolution. Mm-hmm. But even by people who tend to lionize the sort of the rock critics, baby boom rock critics, still sort of looked upon those people who essentially weren't Brits and didn't compose mm-hmm. their own music as being simple-minded. And these guys weren't that.
No, I mean, I was looking on this. I mean, to me, this was the greatest art that I had ever encountered. I fell into the blues when I was 17. I fell into the blues when I was 15. And, it just turned me around. It totally turned me around. And, I mean, I've never recovered from it. But the point is, I started writing, papers in school, in high school, and in college, like Catullus and the Blues. I mean, I flunked those papers, or I got incompletes. I majored in classics in college. I'm writing stuff like that, comparing Robert Johnson with Catullus. I mean, this did not go over with professors, but I believe that this is not to denigrate, Catullus or John Donne or Andrew Marvell or anybody else, but it is to say that what Robert Johnson was about, what Elvis Presley was about, what James Brown was about. I mean, in the 60s, happenings were the big thing in theater. And I remember John Arden wrote a happening. They were sort of these free-flowing, spontaneous kind of theatrical experiences. But I wrote a thing about James Brown back around 67, say. It was the intention was to entice people to come out and see this, because to me this was the greatest theater I had ever seen in my life, and to this day it's the greatest theater I've ever seen in my life. And if people wanted to see a happening, they should forget about these formal, theatrical happenings. Go out and see the James Brown show, and so I wouldn't call it a mission, but I felt I don't want to call it a democratic impulse, but it was the same kind of thing. The same kind of approach that Sam Cooke, that Ray Charles, that Elvis Presley took to music, I felt there were no categories. I felt there was a continuum. I felt and I feel that there is a continuum of great art, a continuum in this case of great American vernacular music, but that's within a larger continuum of great art. And that while there's lots of, lots of things are going to disappear, there's lots of, dross?
yes.
There is, for the things that matter, whether it's Charlie Patton or it's Howlin' Wolf or it's Lefty Frizzell, that these things will last as long as people are there to appreciate anything of quality. And the reason I started writing about music was not because this was what I set out to do, or not because I had any professional ambition that way. I wanted to be a writer, but it was not about music. But I started writing about James Brown, Howlin' Wolf, Bo Diddley, Elvis Presley, to tell people about this music I thought was so great, and at a time when simply writing the name down, writing Muddy Waters down on paper, writing the name Howlin' Wolf was a thrill in itself because you never saw it.
We're out of time. I can only say this has been an amazing experience. My guest is Peter Garonic. His great new book is The Triumph of Sam Cooke, Dream Boogie. Anytime you want to come back, you're more than welcome to come back and do the show, please.
I'm back.
Well, in the interim, I'll thank some people. Our technical director at KCRW in Santa Monica is Mario Diaz, with technical assistant Logic Wojcik at Carnegie Recording Studios. Bob Carlson is the editor. Mary Holch produces the program. I'm Elvis Mitchell. It's The Treatment.
An audio archive of this and other programs can be found at kcrw.com. For questions and comments about The Treatment, please email us at thetreatment@kcrw.com. The Treatment is produced and distributed by KCRW Santa Monica.
You've been listening to KCRW's The Treatment. KCRW offers more than 20 podcasts, including The Business, a look deep inside the business of entertainment with Hollywood's top dealmakers, filmmakers, moguls, artists, and agents, hosted by Claude Brodesser. Check out the podcast of The Business at kcrw.com.